Okay, our final presenter in this session is Shobha Ramanathan, I hope I pronounced that correct, who is a research scientist in the Center for Community-Based Research at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Shobha's research interests center around supporting the dissemination and implementation of evidence-based programs in community settings with an emphasis on capacity building, community collaboration, and leveraging social networks. Her presentation today is entitled Structuring Community-Based Participatory Research to Build Effective Partnerships and Support Sustainability.
Thank you, everyone. As I said earlier, it's a delight to be here and to be part of this wonderful panel. In the interest of time and allowing for questions at the end, since we do have such a great panel, I'll try to make sure I stay sort of under the time limit so we can get to that. So I'm going to share with you today a CBPR project that's actually finished. So it ran from 2005 to 2010. And at the culmination, we've done a lot of reflection on what worked, what didn't work. For many of our community partners and academic partners, this was their first CBPR project. So we really did a lot of evolving along the way in terms of the processes that we used. And that's really what I want to share with you today is just some of the structured approach that we came up with that really helped us facilitate effective partnership building and all with an eye on sustainability. I have no relationships to disclose. I want to start by acknowledging the community partners who were part of this study and who continue to partner with us on a series of CBPR projects. In Boston, we have the Alliance for Community Health and the REACH Coalition. In Lawrence, we have the Mayor's Health Task Force and Worcester's Common Pathways. And all these organizations are community coalitions, just to give you a sense of perspective. This grant was funded by the National Cancer Institute, and the PI is Vish Vishwanath. I also want to acknowledge my co-authors, particularly Josephine Chrysostomo. This is actually her presentation, but she was unable to travel, so I'm here on her behalf. I don't need to define CBPR for you, but I will say that what we try to think about within our group is this idea that these are a series of principles and goals that we aspire to. We don't claim to do this perfectly, but what we are trying to do is think about, again, these ideas of processes and structures that help us achieve these goals and work towards these ideals. And again, that's sort of the angle that we're taking on this. So here's our model for community engagement. We think about this sort of in three buckets. One is structured participation, involving community input, so some of the formative assessments, evaluations, things like that. Facilitating partnerships, so not only within the groups of organizations and institutions that are involved in a given project, but also facilitating partnerships with groups and institutions they may not have access to otherwise. And I'll give you examples of all of these things as we go. And the last piece is the structured collaboration. So again, these formal setups, some of them were mentioned earlier, such as advisory groups, things like that, that just help us stay on track with the CBPR approach. Our second bucket is investment in the community and capacity building. We basically think of how we can infuse fiscal, human, and social capital into our partner communities. And then, of course, this is research at the end of the day on the academic side, so we really try to think about the knowledge production process in terms of getting data that's actually going to be relevant to our community partners, and then on a transfer side, making it usable. And this has been actually one of the greatest challenges we've had, is actually making some of the data that we've collected through these projects relevant, useful, accessible, and all with a side towards action. So to give you a sense about the larger project, this is the Massachusetts Community Networks to Eliminate Cancer Disparities through Education, Research, and Training. It's one of the 25 community network programs funded by NCI, and these were really predominantly infrastructure building grants. So the money was really just there to allow for development of collaborative partnerships between academics, community partners, policymakers, philanthropic organizations, sort of everybody who was working in the sphere of cancer health disparities, being able to have money set aside to develop the networks to build partnerships and with the idea of this long-term growth that would come out of this. And I'll show you some examples of how we think that has been successful in terms of the work that we continue to do with the original members of this Mass Connect project. So the goals, and this was set by the NCI, were to develop and increase the capacity of the three communities by supporting community-based education, research, and training to reduce cancer health disparities. And then the way that each of the CNPs actually went about this was customized based on who was involved. For us, we were interested in developing plans around needs assessments so that each of the communities could really get a sense of what the health priorities were and to come up with some action plans around that. Another example, given the focus on health communication in our group, was to educate local media around the issue of cancer disparities. And I'll give you some examples of that as well. So in terms of structured participation, in the beginning of the project, we did a lot of formative research, so the needs assessments, key informant interviews, things like that, local data reviews, and really had a chance to bring our community partners on board at that point, because this was a new partnership at that point, to really tell us what they saw as the major challenges in their communities. And of course, we got pushback on this idea of focusing on cancer disparities, because they said, yeah, that's nice, but that's really not what our main agenda is. That fits along the continuum of things that we're working on. And so, you know, as a compromise, we certainly had to broaden the range of health topics that we focused on. The good thing with cancer prevention is you can do obesity prevention and a lot of other kinds of prevention, all in the name of cancer prevention, and sort of stick to your funder guidelines. But at the same time, you know, that was sort of an important compromise that we made, and all the future grants that came out of this now speak very broadly about health disparities, because they were, all these coalitions were focusing on health disparities, but again, just sort of on a wider range of topics. And then in terms of facilitating partnerships, again, we felt that as the academic partners, so from Dana-Farber and from the Harvard School of Public Health, we felt that we had access to either policymakers, other institutions, other organizations that our community partners may not normally have had access to. And so we saw an important role for ourselves as facilitating those communications, facilitating those partnerships. And again, I'll give you some examples of that. And then last, in terms of structured collaboration, we did this in a series of ways. We had a community advisory group, which I think is a pretty standard practice at this point, that involved our community partners, some of the academics, and somebody mentioned earlier this idea of a liaison being an important person. And so we had that each coalition had one person who was really just sort of the main Mass Connect liaison. And everyone obviously was invited to attend all these events and these community advisory group meetings, but that one person really sort of served as our point of contact, also did a lot of the negotiation. So that way we had a sort of central person who was allowed to speak on behalf of the coalition at these meetings and sort of serve as their representative at all times. And I think that was really effective. Another way we structured collaboration is that two of the coalitions set up working groups specifically for this project. So that meant they had monthly meetings, they had monthly task force set up specifically, you know, around the work that we were doing around cancer disparities and, you know, with this funding. And that also was a great thing in terms of keeping accountability and keeping the ball rolling at all times on both sides, the community and academics. And the last piece was that our project director made, at a minimum monthly, but by the end weekly, visits to each of our community partners. And so basically she traveled from Boston to Lawrence, which is an hour away, to Worcester, which is an hour away, to attend the monthly meetings, to attend coalition meetings, and then at some point just to attend events that our partners felt were important. And so I think, one of the things that, you know, in the evaluations that we've done, we've gotten a lot of positive feedback, was that whenever they asked, we would show up. And that was consistent. And it wasn't just project staff. Our PIs would show up, show their faces on a regular basis. People, you know, had their cell phones, call them at 7 p.m., 8 p.m. at night to talk about whatever. So I think that sort of accessibility and sort of genuine partnership, I think, really was reflected in that piece. So one example of the needs assessments we did were in Worcester. We had this thing called the Neighborhood Conversations, where residents could basically share their perspectives on health priorities and things like that. And the MassConnect partnership facilitated funding. So through our Translational Science Center at Harvard, we were actually able to fund the entire qualitative research project. We also provided guidance around how do you do the interviews, what kind of guide do you use, all of that. And I think the beauty of this is that this continues today. So, you know, this is a rigorous development of interview guides and modules, as well as a data analysis plan. And this has become a really important data source in the community. People expect to see it. Other organizations use it as part of their program planning. So, you know, sort of this idea of capacity building and sustainability, you know, this is an example of something that lives on. An example of facilitating partnerships, through Dana-Farber's Community Benefits Office, we have a mammography van. And we found there was a tremendous need in Lawrence to have access to mammographies, particularly for the undocumented population, which wouldn't be seeking care through the typical health service that were available in Lawrence, so we bought the van, and then found that the, you know, the rate of first-time mammographies, the rate of follow-up after abnormal diagnosis, all of that was actually twice in Lawrence what it was in the Boston population. So again, it's this idea of fulfilling this unmet need through the partnerships that we were able to leverage. And again, another, you know, testament, I think, to the power of the partnership is that this is ongoing. Now this is a, you know, that there's a working group in Lawrence that focuses on mammography, and the van makes, you know, visits to the community twice a year. So for community, for investment in the community, one of the first questions we often get asked with our new CBPR grants is, well, how much funding are we going to get? So for this one, it was written into the grant that our community partners would get $22,000 per coalition per year, just basically for project maintenance and, you know, for coming to the meetings, things like that. But I think a big part of the resource sharing was the trainings and, you know, capacity building we did for staff, always free of charge to community partners. Also the events that we held in the community. Again, all of these other resources that were brought to the community that they wouldn't have had access to otherwise. In terms of human capital, we did a series of trainings. One I'll show you in a minute is media workshops around how to engage with journalists around cancer disparities and health disparities. And then we also looked at social capital, just again this idea that this was ultimately meant to be a network of academics, community partners, policymakers. You know, are we really fostering the ability to share resources, share information, things like that? Thank you. So this is one of our media workshops. So we had a local media celebrity as part of our panel, which I think was probably the big draw for everyone showing up. But the conversation was really around, you know, is this even something that's talked about in the local papers? Do we even mention health disparities? And if we do, how do we talk about it? And the resulting sort of action part of it is that our community-based organizations were now better equipped to actually engage their local media. So if they have an issue around health disparities, they're able to talk to the journalists, provide them the kind of information they need, and just sort of elevate the issue in their communities. And this is actually successful to the point where we have another leverage grant that's come that's just focused on media advocacy in underserved communities. Social capital. We were looking at the value of intersectoral partnerships and this idea that does it matter if you have greater interaction? Can we show how it matters that, you know, to have these diverse groups at the table, increasing our ability to do the work? And I'll go quickly through this because this could be an entire presentation. But basically, each shape represents a network member. So it could be a CBO, it could be a coalition, a researcher. And if you look at the graph on the left, you see the lines that basically represent the connections between members. And the graph on the right is at year four. And so you can sort of see, just sort of intuitively, there were a lot more connections. There are a lot of more people sort of in the middle of that network. And then the question was, again, does it matter? Like, can we measure the impact? Because we know it matters. But we were actually able to demonstrate that it made a difference in terms of the number of activities that actually happened in the community around cancer disparities. It mattered in terms of grants and publications, and it mattered in terms of policy engagement, because one of our goals also was to start shifting policy around cancer disparities. So another nice outcome that came out of this is our community partners were part of the social network analysis, development, analysis, everything, to the point that they asked us to do training workshops for practitioners on network analysis, not so much the methods and the details of that, but just how do you think about diversity of partnerships? How do you catalog outcomes of partnerships, things like that? So that's been really exciting. And the last piece is the knowledge production and knowledge transfer piece. And I'll give you some examples. These are just some of the kinds of research projects that came out of the grant. Part of this, again, was for training junior investigators to work in CBPR around health disparities. And we had a number of junior investigators participate. You can see some of the topics. So the first one, cancer disparities in context, engaging communities in monitoring and mapping. So this is one of those GIS projects where they sort of looked at all the resources in a community, mapped them physically. This was incredibly challenging for us to figure out how do we translate this out of this sort of very highly technical, sort of software-oriented speech that one of our researchers gave into actionable information. But actually, some of these maps have now been used by our community partners for grants to sort of demonstrate the, you know, food deserts, say, that they have in their communities and things like that. So again, just sort of pulling things out of the regression world into, you know, how do we demonstrate the need based on these kinds of information. And then in terms of knowledge transfer, we had a communication and dissemination working group. And again, that was comprised by members of our advisory group. And we had a series of dissemination vehicles. So one of them is an example here. This is the kind of brief that we would develop based on the research projects. So I showed you very briefly that social network analysis. But basically, we distilled a huge academic endeavor into a front and back of a regular sized piece of paper. And it really took a lot of pulling by our community partners, but we got it down to, what did you find? Why do we care as practitioners? And that's really what we've highlighted. Even, you can see on the bottom left piece of that, it said, what we learned. And then on the right-hand side, it says how social network analysis can help your work. So at the end of the day, why, how do we use this in practice? And we did this for a series of the research projects that came out of this work, again, with this idea of just making the data relevant, accessible, usable. We also created a series of posters so that the community partners could have them up in their local settings or take them to conferences. We had staff attend local conferences and state and national conferences as well, again, just sort of promoting the results of this intervention. And I think through all of that, I think by passing off all of these materials to our community partners, they were able to sort of take it on as their own successes and their own outcomes and then tweak them as needed. So that's been a really nice thing. And it's even ongoing now. Our community partners just presented on the benefits of academic community partners using this MassConnect project as an example last week at a conference, and used materials from this dissemination toolkit. So again, I think this actual toolkit idea, which also included the curricula from our training workshops. So all the trainings we've done, all the handouts, all the materials, all on CD-ROM, so that, again, it lives with them. They don't need to ask us for anything. So that's it. That's our structured model for CBPR. And again, this is a work in progress. It's something that's certainly evolved. We tried to develop more of these processes and have them sort of formalized, whether it was publication policies or whatever, just because we felt that even though we had all entered the room with the right mindset and the best of intentions, the process ended up getting the better of us in a series of ways. And just to have these things written and documented really sort of, I think, helped the negotiation just to ensure that everyone, sort of felt that it was appropriate and equitable. But also, we always have something to refer back to. I think someone else mentioned that earlier, is you have this somewhere documented. You can look back and say, are we actually living by these principles? Are we actually doing what we said we would? So these are just some of the leverage grants that we have, and that's all I have for you. Thank you.
Okay, folks, thank you very much to all of the presenters for doing a great job. One more hand. We have just about 5 minutes left to this session, so if anyone has any questions or comments they'd like to make, in the back. And please try to speak up so everybody can hear you.
This is for the entire panel. Have you, in any of your experience, particularly with the knowledge transfer piece that was just mentioned, have any of your publication used the community-based partners as co-authors, given them the opportunity to own, or at least, show that they have
gained
something?
Who would like to tackle that one first? Everybody's nodding, so I think.
Yeah, no, but I'm asking if you've ever done it, and what are some of the, how do you feel that has helped your partnership? One of the issues with community engagement, I work in a community-based organization, and we try to use academic partnerships, but zero reference to actual names of, community partners and meetings. So I was an academic credit.
Do you want to go?
Yes, we do. In all our conference submission, we have listed our community partners on the abstract. And also, we plan, when we publish papers, we will also plan to include.
Nina, did you want to say something?
All of the tribal publications I've been involved with always have co-partnership and also have to go up through the approval processes to be approved by the appropriate leadership of that, whoever has the authority within the tribe to approve it.
I guess my question is, have you given them the credit and then has something gone back to them so they can see such feeling and know that my name is in this, I can wave it,
yeah.
I learned something?
Well, there's
that's
two. Two things we've done. We do, like I think you've done, we do short community briefs, so and try and publish within the tribal newsletters, so the information goes back directly. But then for the academic publications, it's also co-authored. and they may not use those as much as the community briefs that go directly back to the community. They have them, but they might not use them as much.
I think it would be wrong to not include them on authorship, and like was mentioned, I think, on this previous lecture here, having that upfront and agreement and contractually that you would be included and being a, something that, is based on your participation, I think would be very important to get that in writing, contractual agreements that you need to be included on that, because that's integral. We couldn't be working without your cooperation. The people that we work with take our information back to their senior personnel, back to the people to justify why they should continue working with us. I think it would be real important.
But isn't that always stipulated in your memorandum of understanding? When you connect the community and that community come together, that's usually in the memorandum of understanding.
Yep.
And okay. That they can write papers or maybe presentations without, the other one knowing about it. So if they wanted to be here or wherever something is being presented, they can also be a part of that if they choose. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
And proofread it before submission.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. I just want to chime in as a community member participating in paper writing. So we've been working on 4 papers. We've been getting frustrated with how long it's taking because it's distracting from our work. So that's one drawback. The other thing, and I'll pitch this out to everybody, if anybody has a solution, communities can't access the journals. We cannot get our hands on online a copy of the paper that we've written. Or other articles in the journal. We've worked with Pittsburgh, we've been trying to get it from up. Nobody seems to figure out a way to make that happen other than borrowing people's passcodes.
You want to say something about that?
No. But we've definitely been there on the primary author of one of the papers. We talk about who wants the primary, who wants to hang back because they've got too many other things to do. So it's been very positive, but not without challenges.
One really quick question there.
Venues, the Community Campus Partnerships for Health is putting up training materials. I can't vouch for everybody's.
Yeah.
And then obviously independent CBPR projects or centers put things up on their websites. The other newer kind of initiative of CCPH is the CES for Health, where they're trying to develop a mechanism for people to put up training products, curriculum, whatever, be peer-reviewed nationally so it can help the academic who needs peer review but not in a traditional academic journal, but also get things out in a more timely fashion. It's a much faster turnaround for the CES for Health. Is it cesforhealth.org?
Yes, that's right.
.org, I think.
Yeah. Okay, we're out of time. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you.